Good afternoon and welcome, everybody. It is my great honor to present the speaker to you today, Professor Avner Ofer, who is the Chicchilly Professor of Economic History here at Oxford and Fellow of All Souls College, Emeritus. Professor Ofer has written extensively on post-war economic growth, particularly in developed societies, and the challenge that affluence presents to well-being. His most recent work is on the strife between neoclassical economics and social democracy, each of them vying to shape the post-war decades. The latest among his many publications are The Challenge of Affluence, Self-Control and Well-Being in the United States and Britain since 1950s, came out with Oxford University Press in 2006, and The Nobel Factor, The Prize in Economics, Social Democracy and the Market Turn, with Gabriel Soderberg at Princeton University Press 2016. And the title of his talk today is Quality of Life and Well-Being in Israel Today. Professor Ofer, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I'm going to run away about a quarter to four, so don't be offended. I have to go to something else. But I'll be happy to respond by email if any questions remain. So, how do we measure well-being? This is an issue of the 20th century, and the initial solution was called the national accounts. This is an attempt to aggregate economic well-being by adding up all the trades, all the financial trades in the economy, and there is a headline number which you'll all be familiar with, GDP, or divided by the population, GDP per head. This is not intended as a measure of welfare or as a measure of progress, but that's the way it's been used. As a consequence, since it wasn't intended for that purpose, there are immediately doubts about its validity as a measure of this kind. Because it leaves out a lot of things. For example, it leaves out housework, leaves out leisure, it leaves out the environment. It also leaves in things which shouldn't be in it. We'll go into that in a minute. So this dissatisfaction eventually in the 1960s, in fact quite earlier than that, bred attempts to get closer to what welfare or what well-being is really about. And over the years, three main approaches have crystallized. The first is extending the national accounts by bringing in the things that are left out and throwing out the things that are left in. The second is inventorizing the objective determinants of well-being. So what is the source of well-being? You know, being healthy is usually associated with well-being. So let's look at how healthy people are. Being educated might be thought as a determinant of well-being. It isn't always. So let's see how educated people are. So you decide what the determinants are, and you inventorize them. You see how much have we got of them. The third approach is simply to ask people, how do you feel? Very happy, moderately happy, or unhappy? This is called subjective well-being, or colloquially happiness, and so that's a more psychological way of approaching it. And fairly early on in this project, a paradox emerged, which is named after the person who first published it, the Easterlin paradox, which is that economic growth does not seem to increase happiness, or subjective well-being, or SWB, as I'm going to call it from now on, beyond the basic level. So actually it does increase it a lot when you're very poor, but afterwards it stops increasing well-being, and there's a classic curve which looks like that. So you can see that at low levels what it shows is this is GDP per head, a measure of wealth, or a measure of income actually. And this is a scale of happiness from 2 to 9. And you can see that when your wealth is very low, then every increase in wealth increases well-being by quite a lot. But once you reach a fairly moderate level, $15,000 per head, it levels out. So this is the Easterlin paradox. So I'm now going to go through the three methods. So the first is extended accounts. Extended accounts, this is essentially you start with GDP and you take out the bads. You also add some goods, but let's leave that to one side. So the result is not called GDP, but ISEW, Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare. So you start with GDP per head in the UK, which you can see from 1950 to about 2000, seemed to be growing in a sustainable sort of way. But then lots of the things that are included in GDP are not necessarily good. So for example, if we have more crime and we build more prisons, then that adds up to GDP because someone pays money for that, but that's not necessarily good. Likewise, hospitals, crime, things of that, we employ more policemen, that creates more employment, that creates more income, but that's not good. So you take all these things out. So what do you take out? Take out inequality, that's a bit controversial. Divorce, not because divorce is necessarily bad, but it's economically bad, you know, you lose money. You thought you're going to share everything until death do us part, and then you have to divide everything in the middle, and that's not good. Crime, commuting, things like that, you take them off, and you can see that everything levels off. So from around 1970, there's no increase. And then you say, well, while we're growing, we're also using up irreplaceable natural resources like oil or like temperature, you know, cool temperature. We're using up coolness, if you wish. So if you take that off, you have an even lower level of growth. And it's not even level, it's beginning to decline. Now, the attraction of this kind of measure, it gives you a focal point indicator. So are things getting better? Are things getting worse? We look at ISEW and say things are definitely getting worse. That's very useful. The other thing which comes out of it is what Easterlin already discovered, which is economic growth does not increase welfare. On this account, it actually decreases welfare. Now, this is not the end of the story, because there's one factor which, for some reason, none of these calculations take into account, and that's the effect of land rent. So land rent is not good for anyone except those who get it. And I'll just illustrate this immediately. So if you factor in land rent, maybe economic growth is almost entirely an illusion. Because when house prices rise faster than income, that's not a benefit, that's a cost. Even if you think it's a benefit if you own a house, it's not a benefit if you have to buy one. Yes, the young people here are nodding vigorously. So let's look at Israel. This is the house price to income ratio index in Israel. And you've seen that it's been going up very rapidly. What that means is that people are paying much more for the same thing. What that means is that they have less resources to pay for other things, so economic growth is rising, but they're actually getting poorer. That is actually quite a big thing, because in modern societies, the cost of housing plus the cost of transport is a little less than half of consumer expenditure. So this is really very, very big. So in that respect, economic growth is a bit of an illusion. And in Israel in particular. So if we look here, what we have here is consumer price index for housing. This is the OECD. OECD is the Association of Rich Countries. Some are not so rich, like Mexico, you know, but they've been invited to the club, so we don't question it. Israel has been as well. So you can see that Israel, the cost of housing is rising much faster in Israel over this period than it is even in the OECD, where it is also rising pretty quickly. How many years do you have to work to buy a house in Israel? When I say a house, I mean a unit, an accommodation unit. Well, more than pretty much any other country you would care to live in. So this is the white curve here, 7.5 years in Israel, 2.5 years in the United States. So that's the cost of land rent, which reduces the value of economic growth by quite a lot. Okay. Then there's a second method, which is an inventory of good things, if you wish. So this is devised by the OECD. This, at the moment, is a dominant method that's being used. It's called also the dashboard. So we're not interested in a single indicator. We don't have a way of integrating it all together. We just look at the main domains and see how we're doing in each one of them. And so there are 11 of those here. Some of them are quality of life things. Health status, work-life balance, education and skills, social connection, civic engagement and governance. Some of them are intangibles, as you can see, and others are more tangible. Environmental quality, personal security, subjective well-being. This is the happiness thing. Income and wealth, jobs and earnings, housing. And these things tell you how sustainable this is. Natural capital, economic capital, human capital, that's called education by ordinary people. And social capital, that's called friendship and things of that sort. Honesty is also a social capital. Okay, so that's the inventory method. And that's the third method, is subjective well-being or happiness. This is asking people how happy you are. And when you ask them, a remarkable pattern that emerges is that it doesn't seem to change over time. So everything else changes, but not how happy people are. So this is a typical curve. We chose subjective well-being score. This is between 0 and 9. From 1946, and you can see that it's hardly changed in the United States, it's hardly changed in France, in Japan, it's hardly changed, you know, the French are a little more erratic as you would expect, but on the whole it seems to be very stable. This is in a period where income per head is increased by about threefold. So people are three times wealthier, but they're just about as satisfied as you were. You might observe that there isn't much scope for them to become any happier than they already are. No, they're already pretty happy at the beginning of the period. So that's quite an interesting pattern, which recurs whenever these things are measured over time. So this is the UK, starting in 1973. You can see that GDP is increasing, life satisfaction is stable. Some people will say you don't take into account distribution for most people. Most people haven't actually become any wealthier, especially if they have to pay for housing. But let's put that to one side. This is the Americans. So the curve that's rising is their real GDP per capita, their real income per head. And their happiness, you can see, is that's the brown one, mean happiness. It's stable, perhaps even declining a bit. And this is for Europe. You can see the same story more or less. So this is really quite a strong finding. The finding is that you could say that happiness scores are unreasonably stable and they're also unreasonably high. You know, looking out of the window, the world doesn't look too good. I'm not talking about North Oxford now. But nevertheless, people maintain this cheerfulness, or at any rate, they report themselves cheerful to people who ask them questions. So that's an interesting phenomenon. Now, there's a paradox here. So this whole line of research was started by new left, new agey kind of people who said, well, this GDP is too hard-nosed, the soft things in life also matter. So This is a progressive project, and that's how I started to get interested, being fairly progressive myself. And there's a kind of happiness revolution in 2006 when this kind of burst the surface and everyone started talking about it and it began to influence policy associated with this economist Layard. And then it began to be picked up by conservative governments. For example, New Labour. If anyone wants to contest that this is a conservative government, please write me an email. And the next stage is this Sarkozy committee. So Sarkozy didn't even pretend to be progressive, but he set up this committee with these great names, Stiglitz, Sen, and Fitoussi, who more or less laid down the benchmarks for quality of life research afterwards. And the UK was not far behind, not, by the way, New Labour, but the Conservative government. So they cut the Office of National Statistics as savagely as they cut everything else, but they found money to set up a new unit to measure subjective well-being. And that unit has been reporting ever since, and as you can imagine, things are getting better and better all the time. This is empirical stuff, you know? This is its beauty. Okay. The OECD, the Organization of Rich Countries, started something called the Better Life Initiative in 2011. It said we should measure everybody, and we should measure everybody using the same benchmarks to see whether one country is getting better than the other and so on. So what's going on here? Why has happiness become a conservative cause? We thought the conservatives were the nasty party. Well, my interpretation is that subjective well-being is good news. And so when all the news are bad, then good news is very welcome. And so if people feel good, it matters less if they are not doing well. And that is why I think there is such a mobilization of conservative resources behind quality of life measurements. And Israel is no different than any other country. In fact, it's better than most countries. So you can see this is life satisfaction. Israel. There are two measures. One is happiness and the other is life satisfaction. Happiness is how do you feel now. Life satisfaction, how do you feel about your life. For our purposes, it doesn't matter really. But you can see that this is the OECD average. Again, it's the 1 to 10 scale. And Israel is substantially above that level and also stable. If you say it actually wobbles a bit, it doesn't wobble a great deal. It's actually from 7 to 6.8 and back again. So it doesn't really wobble. It's stable and high. And so the conservatives, of course, take credit for this. So here's Benjamin Netanyahu opening the Knesset in 31 October 2016. Before that, he says, well, we've got a bunch of modern submarines. You won't believe how good they are. This is for people who know what's going on in Israel. But the next thing he says is, a short while ago, the OECD did a satisfaction survey. They call it the measure of happiness. Israel's citizens position themselves as fifth in the developed world in happiness ranking. Young people are even higher. So this is Benjamin Netanyahu. And as I said, the OECD has been putting a lot of resources into this. So they try to monitor well-being on a permanent basis. They issue annual reports. And much of what I'm going to present from now on is actually taken from these reports. So they, you remember that inventory that I showed you, that's what they measure. So they do international comparisons. International rankings, international comparisons. So 11 components of well-being, four capitals. And as soon as they started it, Israel jumped on this wagon and created a big project to generate its own data. This project is as good or better than anywhere else in the world. I've already hinted at what might be motivating this. So Israel is very well equipped with this stuff. And the OECD actually published a monograph 130, 140 pages, a whole book. The very first country in the world which has received this honor of having a monograph entirely dedicated to its well-being using the OECD method. And in 2017, the Israeli Academy of Sciences set up a committee, now I will whisper in your ears, in what seems like apparent ignorance of all these prior efforts, is trying to emulate the same things itself. I have been honored to be appointed to this committee, which is why I'm talking to you here. But I told them I won't spill any secrets. And then, very interesting, there's an institution in Jerusalem called the Haredi Research Institution, which is extremely respectable and produces the best stuff so far about Israel in a report in 2018. And these are the basic findings. Now, you need to adjust yourself to what this graph shows. What this graph shows, the circle, the black circle, is the OECD average. And the blue line is how Israel differs from it on these various indicators, net national income per capita. So you can see that Israel is a bit below average. Now, what is the scale? The scale is standard deviations. Standard deviation, you can think of it as about a third of the distance away from the average in a normal distribution. So let's go through this. So you can see, despite what Netanyahu says, Israel is not actually at the top of everything. So it's actually a little poorer than the average. Satisfaction with living standard is not as high as the average. Employment rate is about average. Satisfaction with housing is very low for reasons which you already know. Housing density, the same thing. Employees working very long hours. So far, everything, all the news are bad here. So far. And then we have the good news. So, first piece of good news is life expectancy. Israel does better than, quite a lot better. And self-reported good health, how things are fine. Now, this is the most interesting paradox here. So Israel is very good at upper secondary educational attainment, but when this is actually tested, it turns out that it's well below average. This is a PISA scores. We cannot resolve this paradox today.
The PISA scores are well below average.
Sorry?
Sorry, did you say the PISA scores are well below average?
Yes, well below average, yes. Despite Israel being super educated. Maybe they're learning the wrong things. Is there someone you can count on for help? Actually, despite what we might expect, this is below average. Confidence in national government. Volunteer time, a little below average. Again, maybe a bit of a surprise. This is air pollution. Very bad indeed. Death by assault. Israel is dangerous, but objectively it isn't. Feelings of safety. Life satisfaction. See, that's what Israel is best at. I'm all right, Jack. You know, people feel very good about themselves in Israel. Okay, so that's the OECD average. Now, an important measure is inequality and poverty. So where does Israel stand? This also is one area where Israel is very close to being world champion. This is a standard measure of inequality. The Gini coefficient, it goes from 0 to 1 or from 1 to 100 according to preference. And this is the OECD average. It says the top 10 countries. What it means is the bottom 10 countries, or the ones with the highest scores, yes? And you can see that Israel is, together a respectable company of the United States and the United Kingdom, is very close to being the developed world champion of inequality. And as for poverty, it's an even better position. So you can see that Israel is second only to Mexico in the amount of poverty. Poverty is defined as below 50% of median income. So that's actually quite a low measure of poverty. So there's an enormous amount of poverty in Israel compared with other OECD countries. Okay, so we have a little paradox here, or paradox, mystery if you wish, that the United States and Israel have, both of them have peak inequality. I have another study here. If you lower the number of OECD countries to 24, then Israel and the United States come up joint first with a Gini coefficient of 44, which is some people would regard as alarmingly high. Now, you might wonder, what do these two countries have in common? You know, one is a colossal giant and the other is, you know, a tiny speck on the Eastern Mediterranean. Apart from their indissoluble alliance, the mysterious alliance between these two countries, they also have this in common. They do have some things, and both have strong market commitment and weak welfare state, so that might have something to do with it. But I'd like to introduce another element, which is what I'm going to talk about for the rest of my talk. Let me just get my watch out and make sure that I don't take too much of your time. And that is identity and gender. These are things that don't normally come into the discussion of inequality, but I'd like to introduce them. Both these countries have what I call large identity minorities with standard of living shortfalls. In the United States, it's the blacks and Latinos. They're about 30% of the population. They're much worse off than the rest of the population. In Israel, it's the Arabs and the Orthodox Jews, and they're almost the same percentage of the population. So these are identity minorities. They also have large groups of people who think of themselves as a majority, but somehow being on the periphery. So I call them marginalized majority identities. They're actually not majorities, but they like to think themselves as representing the essence of the community, or the true, they are the true people. So in the United States, it's the white working class and the evangelicals. In Israel, it's Mizrahi Jews of Arab-speaking country of origin. In some respects, politically similar types of majority identitarians. And they also have perceived standard of living shortfalls. I say perceived because someone who looked at this said that, in fact, the Mizrahi Jews are not so badly off as they, some of them think they are. Okay, so I think one way into this is actually to look at the United States. So what we have here is a graph of family dynamics and gender inequalities. What this is about, let's start with family types. Family types, you know, the period is 67 to about 2000. This is dynamic, so it shows changes over time. Family types, this is the male breadwinner family, declines from 2/3 to 1/3 over this period. And it's displaced by the double earner family, which rises from 30 to 50%. And then we have quite a large group of woman-only households. This is with children, and a smaller one of men only. Let's compare this to black families. So this is the male breadwinner family declining from 1/3 to about 10%, a little over 10%. The two earner family is bumping along the 30%, and the growing sector is the woman only household. And then the men only is fairly small, like the whites. Now let's look at the income of these groups. So the first thing is that look at the real median family income of the most successful family type, which is the two-earner family. So you can see that the blacks earn rather less than the whites in this group. But the important thing is that that group is a much smaller one in the black community than in the white community. So in the white community, this high earning, the only group with the rising incomes, is actually expanding. So this family type is expanding. So you can see at least 50% of the family types are actually getting better off. If you compare this to the blacks, well, the black rising family type is by far the poorest. So what we can see is that the differences in income are associated with differences in gender within the identity minority. Yes, the blacks are the identity minority I'm talking about. So let's look at Israel now. Income and employment by identity and gender. So this is income per head. We have three groups here. One is Orthodox Jews. This is income per head. The other is non-Orthodox Jews, and the third is Arabs. You can see that the two identity minorities have an income that's about half, income per head, that's about half of that of non-Orthodox Jews. What about employment? So the distinctive gendered employment patterns among men to begin with. So remember, the Browns is the Orthodox men, and you can see that their labor force participation from, this starts in 1980, so labor force participation declines from 60% to about 35% over this period of, shall we call it, right-wing dominance in Israeli politics, and it's beginning to climb again, but not very much. The Arabs are below average. The yellow line is the average of everyone. So the Arabs are below average, this is men, but their participation has been increasing. And then the others, yes, the non-Orthodox Jews, they have high labor, they have high male labor participation rates, more than 80%. Just for comparison, the United States is under 60%, the same figure. So this is actually rather high labor participation rates. Now let's look at the employment of women. And the striking thing here is that Haredi women, this is the brown, are not far below the average and have now converged on the average. In this case, it's Arab women who are excluded, as it were, from the labor force. So you can see their labor force participation is much, much lower. So what we can see is that these two identity minorities, what defines their identity is different gender roles in the labor market. It's very different forms of gender participation in the labor market. This is a political economy interpretation of what is going on here. So identity minorities discriminate against women. That's an essential feature of their identity, to discriminate against women. Gender inequality increases income inequality, because in the world of today, maximizing family income means that both partners are working. Now, the marginalized majorities, you know, I describe them as white working class in the States and Mizrahi in Israel, resent identity minorities. So there's a tension between the majority minorities and the minority minorities. And I've even written this up. So in America, they vote for Trump. In Israel, they vote for Bibi. And the vote is a kind of gesture of opposition to yet another group, to a minority group. That is the main substance, I think, or arguably that is the main substance of these votes. There's also, in the political economy of these countries, there's big business and big finance. Big business and big finance support the marginalized majority biases in return for their votes. So in the United States, the Republican Party is allied with the white working class to support Trump. In Israel, the tycoons, the big business, are allied with the Likud, and they use these votes to implement their business finance agenda. And thus, the identity voting underpins right-wing anti-equality politics. So it's not only the gender discrimination, but also the anti-welfare state politics, which is implemented with identity votes. That is the system. And the irony here is just as the right wing has appropriated happiness from the left also came up with identity, and the right wing has appropriated identity politics from the left. In addition to that, in Israel, there's a special story, which is the Orthodox Jews cut a deal with the marginalized majority. So there's a political alliance between the Haredi parties and the Likud. And the purpose of it, as far as the Orthodox are concerned, is to keep women in their place, not only within their communities, but in every other community. And so what I argue here is that the extreme inequality that we see both in Israel and in the United States at very similar levels is driven by identity and gender. One of the consequences of this is that if you marginalize women, one of the responses is high birth rates. If women are denied autonomy, denied agency, then one of the consequences is high birth rates. And this is another thing which Israel is a leader, way ahead of everyone else. So this is the number of children per woman in the OECD. This dotted line is the level required for reproducing the population. And you can see that Israel here is way ahead of any other country. It's actually been rising a bit. These dots represent the previous, 1970, 1995, 2016. So Israel is even higher than it was in 1995 at about 3 children per woman, lifetime completed fertility. And we can project this into the future. We can project the size of the different communities. So this is what it is today, or 2009. So you can see that the Haredi is a sizable slice, the Arabs are an even larger slice, but most of the pie is made up of non-Orthodox Jews. By 2034, both of these communities are much larger, and this community is noticeably smaller. And by 2059, together they achieve parity with the rest of society. So far we've been talking about 3 groups. Is that everyone that's available for counting? Well, the OECD actually, on every title, every chapter heading, it has this reservation. It prints this reservation. The statistical data for Israel are supplied by and under the responsibility of the relevant Israeli authorities. The use of such data is without prejudice to the status of the Golan Heights, East Jerusalem, and Israeli settlements in the West Bank. So, by the way, it's impossible. That's one of the things that came up in the discussions of our committee, that the historical Israel within the Green Line no longer exists as a statistical entity. So it's impossible actually to measure what's going on there. So who counts? Well, the Israeli settlers in the West Bank, they do count because they're Israeli citizens. Who doesn't count? Well, Arabs in East Jerusalem, Arabs in Area C, Palestinian Authority in Gaza, all of them under direct or indirect Israeli control. All of these people in this entity, whatever you want to call it, are not counted for. Sorry?
How is it justified? What does it matter if they're citizens or not? They're part of the economy.
Sorry?
How do they justify income?
They're not counted for quality of life measures according to the OECD methodology.
Why?
It's interesting you raise this. We raised this in the community discussions. I'm supposed not to tell you any secrets. I'll tell you the secrets. Don't tell anyone else. We raised this question. We actually said, some of us said, let's do just the green line Israel. So the statistician there said, you can't do that because it doesn't exist for statistical purposes. So let's do everything. So he said, you can't do that either because that's Palestinian Authority. So we're stuck with these measurements, which include Area C and apparently include the settlers, as far as I understand. But it's just worth remembering that when we're measuring quality of life, not everyone counts equally. Yeah? Now, you also might have noticed that there's a big group which sometimes identifies itself as separate. Maybe they're non-Haredi religious Jews, or maybe they're Mizrahi Jews who don't appear as a group here. I think ideally we'd like to have them in some form or other, but we don't. The point really is that these averages, these large averages, are misleading, and what we have is distinctive identity groups who live under different jurisdictions with different sets of entitlements and rights. And so the aggregate averages are misleading. Quality of life is also determined by identity. Historically, quality of life measurement is focused on outcomes for individuals. That arises from its origins in economics. Economics is a very individualistic sort of discipline which considers the outcome only meaningful for individuals. It doesn't see beyond the individual. Nevertheless, I think it's part of everyone's experience that one derives considerable value from membership in larger groups. Support of a football team, you know, being a member of a nationality. So that's not consistent with the tradition of quality of life measurement. And when our committee got together, I made that point in the committee, and everyone scratched their head and said, you're right, why don't you do something about it? So that's my job in this committee. In other words, to devise measures for the value that people derive from their identity. So I'm going to present to you for the first time ever what my tentative findings, or what my tentative approach is, and you can give me a verdict whether it makes sense or not. Yes, I said that. People derive satisfaction from identity and group membership. We'd like to incorporate that into the OECD battery, as it were, to take account of that. Before that, how important is identity? How important is history, culture, all of these things? Well, it turns out it's enormously important. So this is derived from some previous work I've done. And for those of you who like this kind of thing, this is a regression of happiness. It's regressed on, first on income. Well, it's controlled for income. So income actually doesn't count for very much. I just mentioned it up there, how much it counts for. One percentage point. Yeah, what this measures is the percentage very happy. I said, when we survey subjective well-being, we ask people, how happy are you? Very happy, moderately happy, not very happy. So this is a percent very happy, and we normalize it to zero at 26%. And then we ask people, we control for income for all of these countries, so that's left out of it, but it doesn't count for very much. And then we ask, how important is relative income? Being in the lower third or being in the upper third, how much does that count? Also not terribly much. What really matters enormously is where you are, which country you're in. And there's some surprises here. The big surprise is that Latin America is unreasonably happy squared. You know, they're really off the scale. So look at Mexico and Venezuela. They're not kind of poster boys for happiness, but if you ask them, they say they're terribly happy. Then the next in line is the sort of places you could expect, really, like the Netherlands. Then UK isn't here for some reason. Netherlands, Denmark, Canada, Ireland. Here, South Africa is another kind of outlier. And you can go through this. Being in the former Soviet Union is not a recipe for happiness. Maybe they miss the Soviet Union. At any rate, the point of presenting this is that identity is extremely important for subjective well-being, at any rate. That's relative income. Initially, we talked about identity and culture, and as I started thinking about this, I arrived at a point which is not being left uncontested, that culture and identity are not the same thing. So what is culture? In my book, culture is science, art, literature, music, parks, landscape, all the things bright and beautiful that we have been taught to value from the Enlightenment onwards. That is the legacy of the Enlightenment. How do we know they're good? Because wise people told us so, and we learned that at school. And they're typically funded by government and not-for-profit. There is even a concept in economics. They're called merit goods, so they don't have to be justified in terms of their economic payoff. They're just goods in themselves. That's culture. That's contestable. There's another thing which... Oh, yes, I said that. And so I said these are goods in themselves, and in the context of a national identity, I'd say these constitute our links with the rest of humanity. We can agree, I think, all of you here, that classical music is wonderful. Do we agree on that? Mm-hmm. I've come to the wrong place there. But at any rate, this is interesting. When I began to think about this, I began to think of, can I identify a capital city without a symphony orchestra? Well, Tehran has a symphony orchestra, Cairo has a symphony orchestra, Istanbul has a symphony orchestra, Tokyo has a symphony orchestra, Seoul has a symphony orchestra. So, you know, this is something that everyone thinks is good. And that's something we can talk about with people in other countries, agree upon with people in other countries. Identity is something different. I call it, the economic term is, a club good. This is a kind of good which is available only if you're a member of the club, only if you're an insider. So religious groups, ethnic groups, nationality, I throw in sports, if you're a football supporter, you know, it works in a similar type of way. It matters to people's well-being very substantially, but how much? How do we evaluate or measure how important this is to people? And here I'd like to present a general principle. The principle is, how do we think about norms in general, like telling the truth, something of that sort, yes? A norm is only interesting if it requires some sort of sacrifice. If a norm is aligned with your interests, then it's redundant. You don't need the norm to explain your behavior because your interest is sufficient. So a norm is only interesting if it requires a sacrifice. So the method then is, or the insight, if such it is that the value of the norm is greater to you than the sacrifice incurred. Let's imagine that I find a wallet on the pavement with £1,000. And so naturally I go to the police station and hope that they will hand it over to the person who lost it. And presumably the norm of honesty in this case is worth at least £1,000 to me. That's basically the method. So let's look at the Haredi Jews. The male children don't study science, mathematics, and foreign languages. That's a disadvantage in the labor force, so they have a lower standard of living. Presumably, the identity is worth more to them than that sacrifice. That's the method I propose to use. In other words, the shortfall is a measure of the advantage. And they have the highest subjective well-being of any identity group in Israel, Haredi Jews. So identity groups typically suffer a disadvantage or shortfall. That's why I don't think of, for example, the classic music lovers club assembled here as an identity group, because you're all privileged, you know, you haven't sacrificed anything for this, so it's not really interesting. But identity groups that are salient normally suffer some disadvantage or shortfall. Let's look at identity. Well, Israel is rife with identity politics. We have these categories, the survey categories of Haredi, Arab, and the rest. There's also the fourth group I said, which is the Mizrahi or maybe non-Haredi religious. Are they disadvantaged systemically? You know, are these non-Haredi religious or Mizrahi people, are they disadvantaged systemically? I would have thought so, but not everyone is sure about this. At any rate, the Shas party is based on the premise that they are. And, you know, that's proved, that's been sufficient to mobilize a certain amount of votes. The Likud is explicitly anti-Arab. The latest expression of this is the nationality law, which gave Jews precedence over Arabs in Israel. So that's again a kind of identity appeal or identity vote. The Minister of Culture is, you know, almost designed for the purpose of this lecture, because what she does is to mobilize these identities against the universalist culture. So she validates my classification by saying, I haven't read Chekhov and I don't plan to. So I would characterize her as a minister of identity, not as a minister of culture, although her job is to be minister of culture. Now, there's an interesting question. Is identity a matter of personal choice? Do you have a choice in being a Haredi Jew, or maybe an Arab, or maybe a Mizrahi, or one of these other things? And the answer to this is that you cannot shed identity very easily, because it's the glue of social affinity, and it's underpinned by very powerful sanctions. So being excluded from your identity group is very, very costly. In extreme cases, you might even be murdered for it. And so if there are exit and entry options, they're rather costly. So I think we don't need to dwell too much on the matter of choice. So the argument here is that the subjective benefits of identity are greater than the objective sum of disadvantage. That is my measurement. That is my proposed measurement method. To see to what extent membership in an identity group involves a sacrifice, and to say, arbitrarily perhaps, is that the identity is worth more than these sacrifices. How do we measure disadvantage? On all these social indicators. We just look at how these groups, how the identity groups fare on the social indicators, how they score on all the social indicators. That allows us to see whether there's a shortfall there or not. And here we have another graph of the same kind, which looks at the two main minority identity groups in Israel, the Haredi and the Arabs. And the comparison group here, the dark blue, is non-Haredi Jews. So let's look at the Arabs. This is the gray figure. You can see that the Arabs suffer shortfalls in every domain except one. The one they don't suffer a shortfall on is health satisfaction. So they are satisfied with their health as everyone else, but in every other respect they're below average. So they really have a hard time compared with the general Jewish non-Haredi population. With regard to the Haredi, the picture is a little more mixed. So what shortfalls do they suffer? They lower labor participation rate, if that is a disadvantage. Freedom from disability, they actually suffer more from disability. Freedom from disability, they're actually doing better. Health satisfaction, they're doing better. Tertiary educational study, they don't go to university, and yeshivas don't count. Somebody to count on, that's interesting, you know. So although they have this image that they look after each other, it looks out that they're no more than average on that. Volunteering, they seem to be keen on volunteering. Freedom for physical assault, so on. So actually the Haredi Jews do better than the average on most of these measures. This is not, by the way, exhaustive. The things I haven't included, the housing, I haven't included housing here, or income, things of that sort. But I will in a moment. So let's look at that. This is income distribution by population group. So we have five populations. This is the lowest, and this is the highest. They're divided into five. These are quintiles, five. And you can see that the lowest quintile is populated almost entirely by Arabs here and by Haredi Jews. So this is where poverty is concentrated in Israel. And there are fewer and fewer of them as you go up towards the top. The non-Orthodox Jewish population is divided about equally. It's a kind of normal curve. No, it's actually increasing towards the top. So they're doing okay. And you find them in all income groups. However, this is by far the largest group. So if you look at where poverty is concentrated in Israel, you can see that about half the poor in Israel are Arabs. There's quite a large chunk of Haredi, but there's still quite a large chunk of non-Haredi Jews who are poor because this is the largest community. So there's no question that these Haredi Jews are deprived in the sense of having lower incomes. They're poor, basically. And very few of them are even in the fifth quintile, in the top quintile, which is the top 20%. That's a very big group, you know. School teachers are in that group. Public school teachers, okay. Sorry. Okay. Now, this is for connoisseurs. So this is a regression. What is this? Regression shows the average deviation of life satisfaction of the individual relative to a non-Haredi Jewish woman. That's the point of reference. And what these figures measure is whether the particular category here, so we have a whole set of categories, varies from this non-Haredi Jewish woman and by how much. So we have three models. This is just the main thing. So what you can see here is that when you take just these variables, male, age, H square is a nonlinear measure of age, so it goes like that instead of like that. Income, secondary education, tertiary education. So everything is good except getting older. I'm not sure I agree with that. And in fact, the statistic doesn't agree with that, because if you take the age squared, which is a nonlinear, it turns out that the older the better. That's my experience. Then you have a full model here. We don't need to dwell on this because that's not the interesting one. This is really the interesting one, which has all the variables. Some things make you feel bad, like being a male or being older, although not being older squared. Education makes you feel better, secondary education makes you feel better, tertiary education makes you feel worse. You've come to the wrong place, folks. Unemployed, that's definitely a big minus. Social connections make you feel, well, you know, it's all more or less as you'd expect. Security, if you feel insecure, presumably, that makes you feel, no, if you feel secure, that makes you feel worse. It depends on how it's scaled. Environmental quality, if it's high, you feel high. Health status, again, it depends on how it's scaled. Working long hours makes you feel bad. Now, this is the clincher. How is it measured, by the way? You know, I'm not sure. They regard it, this is important because the question is, can these coefficients be compared with each other? And the answer is, I don't know. It depends on which method they've used, which they haven't bothered to disclose. So maybe they can and maybe they can't. But it doesn't matter because in the variables that do matter, they are comparable. And that is, oh yes, and the coefficients show by how much, negative or positive. And what it shows is that after controlling for all the objective shortfalls and advantages, both Arabs and Haredi score positive on identity. So you'd expect, you know, the Arabs suffering all this discrimination would feel bad about being Arab. No, they feel good about being Arab. So this is a kind of confirmation. Had they not done it for me, the OECD, without knowing what they were doing, they didn't know they were confirming my hypothesis. But had they not done it for me, I would have done it myself and hopefully have found the same thing. So what you can see is that identity actually compensates for shortfalls, attenuate in terms of life satisfaction. That's all we've got here, life satisfaction. So confirmation of identity, so this is a confirmation of my model. And we've reached the conclusion, a bit late. So Israel is divided in an unequal society with strong identity subgroups and focal points, falls within OECD parameters except for the birth rate, extreme inequality and poverty, high level of subjective well-being, inequalities and divisions run more along identity than class lines, most distinctive identity groups reject the value of equality. I think that's an important point. There's a norm against equality in the distinctive identity groups, within the group for women and externally for some of the other identities. Inside, the women are largely complicit with this. So, you know, I used to say, well, it's not a surprise that the Haredi have a high subjective well-being. If I didn't have to go to work, I'd also have a high subjective well-being. And indeed, I don't have to go to work, and I do have a high subjective well-being. But it turns out that Haredi women have even higher subjective well-being than Haredi men. So go figure. In the short run, identity equalizes life satisfaction, even for the victims of discrimination and denial. So identity is a kind of equalizer in this story. In the long run, it threatens to undermine the existence of civil society in Israel and perhaps its very existence as a secular state because of the high birth rate among illiberal and anti-pluralist identities. Thank you very much.